will come back and organize as the bonding committee, and I'll have the secretary call the roll.
Brown? Heineman?
Here.
Lucas?
Here.
Peters?
Here.
Sohold? Teason?
Here.
Gosch? Holly?
Here.
Hoffman?
Here.
Letterell? Olson?
Here.
Tyler?
Here.
Westra? Carson?
Here.
Maher?
Here.
Quorum is present.
All right. So where do we want to start? We'll start with Mike with the South Dakota Conservancy District.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Perkovich. I'm the program administrator for the Water and Waste Funding Program within DNR. The report that you have that we submitted to you can six distinct sections. I'm going to spend most of the time going over the executive summary, which is highlights the program overview and what we did in the past year. By way of introduction, the Board of Water and Natural Resources is authorized to administer our Clean Water and Drinking Water SRF State Revolving Fund programs, and the Board of Water and Natural Resources also serves as the board for the South Dakota Conservancy District. The two state revolving funds are low-interest loan programs, and the Clean Water was established in 1989, and the Drinking Water was established in 1997. These are federal programs operated under the jurisdiction of the Environmental Protection Agency, and the federal government provides annual capitalization grants to each state to help fund the program. The funds that we receive must be matched on a 5-to-1 basis. So for every $5 the federal government gives us in capitalization grants, the state is required to match $1. Our primary source of match funds for the program is through the issuance of bonds. And then again, periodically, the Conservancy District also issues bonds above that required for the state match to meet the program demand. And in the SRF parlance, these are known as our leverage bonds. In the last state fiscal year, the Conservancy District did not issue any bonds. However, the program's still active and up and going. So on page 3, it does show a list of the 17 bond issues that we have issued in the past. This is totals a par value of just over $500 million. And as you can see, it breaks out the uses of the bonds for whether it was used for state match, for our leverage program, or for our leverage funds, or if we used them to refund prior bond issues. On table 2 below there, we have almost $269,000 of outstanding bond principal remaining. And then again, since we didn't have any bonding activity last year, I would like to summarize the loans that we made in the 2013 year. Our Clean Water SRF program, we made 22 loans, and that totaled about $50.7 million. In our drinking water program, we made 13 loans totaling $17.5 million. I would like to point out that the two programs have provided nearly $934 million to South Dakota communities since their inception. So I expect that if I'm in front of this board next year, I will have the pleasure to say that we have provided $1 billion to South Dakota communities. So that's the executive summary of the report. The next section is our unaudited financial statements. I would note that we have the legislative audit in our offices as we speak, doing our audit for these. And then the next program is the next two sections just give more history on the Clean Water and Drinking Water SRF programs. It lists all the loans we made and gives a brief description for each of the loans. The fifth section is our bond issue summary. For every bond issue, we've got the par amount and the ratings and who the financial team was and that type of information. And then the last section of the reports are the statutes that authorize the Conservancy District to issue bonds and also the establishment of the drinking water and clean water SRF programs. That's a quick summary of our activities for the past year. I'd certainly be glad to entertain any questions if there are any.
Great. Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, looks like you get off easy today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can I have a motion to adopt the conservation district? Motion by Carson, second by Hoffman. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next, Travis, with the Economic Development Finance Authority.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
My morning. Name is
Travis Dover. I'm with the Governor's Office of Economic Development. I also serve as the loan officer for the EDFA Pooled Loan Bond Program. With me is Legina Gruis, who is the loan officer for the Apex Loan Program. The Economic Development Finance Authority is a seven-member board made up of members of various business and lending backgrounds, comprised of various political affiliations. The EDFA is responsible for two of GOED's lending programs, and on the second page of the handout is a summary of activity for the past year. The Apex Loan Program, egg processing and export, is primarily driven to create jobs in communities of 25,000 population or less. It looks for either egg processing businesses or manufacturing primarily, and the source of those funds is from USDA Rural Development. The EDFA is also responsible for the Pooled Loan Bond Program, in which the EDFA issues bonds into the market and then uses those proceeds to make loans to a borrower. And those businesses as well have to either process industrial ag processing or heavy manufacturing, that they are not eligible for retail or other types of development. And both of these loan programs are for fixed asset financing, and they're permanent takeout financing, requiring the project to have an interim lender on board. So in the last fiscal year, there was four Apex loans approved by the EDFA and one bond loan program. This was an increase from last year, in which there was only two Apex loans and zero bond programs. So we have seen some more increase in our economic development programs under the EDFA. Moving on in the report into the audit, I will start with the bad news and then work into the good news. The EDFA approved the audit report as conducted by legislative audit at their meeting on November 5th. The audit was mostly in good shape with internal controls, but there was one non-compliance audit finding. It was we did not have sufficient documentation in one of the files. After reviewing everything else, we have determined that it is an isolated incident, and the appropriate corrective actions have been implemented to require. We've added an addendum into the version of the application that's required, so we believe that we have this fully resolved, and we'll continue with our clean audits coming up next year. Moving on to page 7, a brief highlights and discussion of the financial performance. In fiscal year 13, $1,315,000 of bonds were retired, so the total assets in the portfolio decreased due to loan repayment, and total liabilities decreased as well due to redemption of the bonds. So net year over year, the total change in net position was just shy of an increase of $25,000. So it was a turnaround from last year, in which there was some heavy contractual services that caused for a decline. Overall, for the bonds, the remaining bonds outstanding is about $18.5 million bonds. As I mentioned earlier, there was one new loan approved at the time of, in fiscal year 13, those bonds had not been sold, but they've just within the last week, there was a $10 million taxable bond issuance was sold that will be reflected in next year's report. So most of the bonds that the authority issues are backed by real estate collateral. They're 20-year bond deals callable after 10 years. So some of the older loans in the portfolio will be coming up on their call period, and depending what the interest environment does, we may or may not see those borrowers pay off early and refinance with other mechanisms. So there's the brief overview of the EDFA for the past year, and I'd be happy to answer any questions of the committee at this time.
Well, thank you. Are there any pertinent questions of the committee? Charlie.
Thank you, Chairman Maher. And the question is, when we put it into statute that the state of South Dakota is always going to be debt-free, and we will never go into debt. We pay our bills, and our bond rating was supposed to reflect that. Have you seen that in any of the transactions in the bond markets pertaining to our getting a better yield on the bonds that we...
With the recent bond issuance, we use, the EDFA uses Doherty & Company as the bond underwriter. And as part of that process, they engage Standard & Poor's to validate the state's AA plus rating, and then with the authority being one notch below the state's rating. So I guess as far as the bond market, I really can't speak to how the rating reflects totally in the market, as with the EDFA not having a lot of activity over the past few years, the pricing on the bonds was a combination of how active EDFA participates in that bond market, the value of the other loans in the pool, and things of that nature. But they did seem to go at a reasonable A-plus investment grade.
You can't get a much better rating in South Dakota.
Don, I think, can answer your question.
Don Templeton with the South Dakota Building Authority.
Thank you. Yep.
Is this on?
They're live.
Is this on?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. We just priced a South Dakota Building Authority bond issue last week, and the state received the same rating, AA-plus, from Standard & Poor's. We've been working with the governor's office to promote some practices that would increase the rating for the state, and I think the plan is to put together a game plan, and with the changes, and approach Standard & Poor's and Moody's at a future date, because they just did a mass rating of all the states, I believe, this month, or within the last couple of months. So the state's rating has remained the same. We did get increased, I think, a couple of years ago from AA to AA plus.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Any further questions for Travis? Seeing none, thank you, sir. Do I have a motion to approve the... Okay. Motion by Carson. Second by Lateral. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Board's approved. Don, with the Building Authority.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Mr. Vice Chair and committee members. I'm a little under the weather. I'm fighting pneumonia. But I'll try to get through it, and if I don't, Steve Corbin, our finance officer, can finish. But I've got two reports on the agenda, the Building Authority and the Health and Educational Facilities Authority. Neither one have new bond issues this year, but the Building Authority, we will have one next week. But if I could make time to go through a special report, Educational Enhancement Funding Corporation, it tells a good story where we believe a lot of additional money will go into the Educational Enhancement Trust Fund, which was created from tobacco,
sure,
MSA payments. Would that be acceptable?
Yes, you bet. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to start. What's the agenda call for? Which report first?
Building is first, okay. But if probably just real briefly, because there hasn't been anything new since last year. Or?
No. But just on page one, briefly, our biggest borrower for the Building Authority is the Board of Regents. I'm going to be going through some new projects that we priced for the Building Authority. In addition to a game fishing parks, we're doing a project. So that's kind of what we do. Our chairman, on page two, our chairman is Tom Graham from Sioux Falls. And we have a great board. Dennis Hahn is in the oil business in Rapid. DJ Mertens from Kennebec. Doug Hayek, Sioux Falls. Jolene Spearfish, Dennis Negerbauer, Sioux Falls, and Jim Roby is an attorney up in Watertown. And I'd like to thank the legislative members for being supportive of our authority. Tom Graham has served as chairman, I think since like 1986. So it's appreciate it when I have to come up and testify that appreciate your vote in support of our board. Page 3 has a picture of what interest rates have done over the past 10 years. We do this over January 3rd and July 3rd, so it's like semi-annual plotting a graph. These are 30-year revenue bonds from 25 various bond issues, tax-exempt bond issues selected, mostly AA, Standard & Poor's rating. Now, page 4 kind of gives you a snapshot of what current interest rates look like. And and you might want to write this down. November 15th, it wound up at 5.23, so it's jumped a little bit since this date of October 31st. If you turn to page 7, we just priced the bond issue. We expect to close next week on a couple of game fish and parks projects. One is Angostura sewer system. Another one is the Cedar Shores Resort in Oklahoma. They're having problems with the shale sliding down the hill. So it's a stabilization project. The Board of Regents has a number of projects, infrastructure projects. I won't go into detail. New building projects, I'll just walk through. Jonas Hall out at Black Hills State. Johnson Fine Arts up in Aberdeen. SDSU's got 3 new projects, the head house and greenhouse project, architectural math engineering building, and a new cow-calf research unit. USD's got 3 projects, a science building, Patterson Hall renovation, and then arena, which it's going to be a basketball arena. I can just quick give you the interest rates if you would like to know. We had 3 series of bonds. Series B went out 25 years, and that was for the Board of Regents projects and part of the USD arena project, and that was 4.4% all in TIC, which is total interest cost. A Series C is what's that, 5 or 8 years? I think it's 5 years. That was a taxable component of the USD sports complex because there was a naming rights agreement associated with it. We have to do a lot of testing because IRS bonding regulations exclude private use. So if there's private use involved with it, then you normally do a taxable bond issue so you don't put your other portion of the bonds in jeopardy. Series B, C was taxable, $10 million, 1.93%. That's a lot lower because it wasn't going out.
It wasn't what? 1.9% and it wasn't a lot lower?
It was a lot lower due to the maturities were a lot shorter.
Oh, okay.
They structured the taxable's first maturity and then the tax-exempt further down because normally tax-exempt bonds are a lower interest rate.
And then the Series C is 5 to 8 years, you say?
Series D is 25 years.
C?
Oh, C is
5 years. Okay.
Series D is Game Fish and Parks. That's 25 years at 5.32%. Now, that's a little bit higher because they're taxable. And that had to be done because of the lease arrangement between
I believe it's Regency and Cedar Shores. And then Angostura had private use due to there's leases with landowners around the lake.
When you say TIC, that was on that Series B total interest cost, that means the interest is what? What's that mean, total interest cost?
That's figuring in along with the cost of issuance.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
I got a map of some of the projects that we financed that on page 12. I thought would be helpful because you can kind of see what the building authority has issued in your districts.
Nothing in Northwestern South Dakota.
We're working on it.
There's nothing up there. nothing. Yeah, too much risk. Can't find anybody to buy that bond.
I guess that's all I have.
Sure. Yep, we'll do this report. Can I have a motion to accept this report?
Second.
Motion by Heineman, second by Teason. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Which one would you like to go to next?
Let's do the health and ed. If you would turn to page 4 again. It's the same graph, but I just wanted to say last year at this meeting, we reported on 10 different bond issues. We don't have any to report during this last 12 months, but we are currently working with Southeast Technical Institute. Last year's legislature approved a $20 million building facility at the southwest corner of their campus, and it looks like the time frame to do that bond issue looks like they'll be ready next spring of 2014. I got some more maps, and might get the same comment on the northern part of these two. But anyway, you can see the map 9 is the healthcare projects around the state. And page 10 is the educational projects that we've financed around the state.
Is that for like schools, school additions, buildings? Is that essentially?
Like Miller School District. All the school districts that you see on this map have been capital outlay certificates. We did quite a few of them in the past. They've seemed to, they haven't gone through our authority lately. They've just found it easier. We had tougher restrictions reporting than they could do on their own, and I guess it's just they've done it locally is what we've seen for a trend. And I guess that's all I have to report, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do you have a motion to accept the education and health facilities report?
So
motion by Charlie Hoffman, second by Representative Tyler. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. And then the educational enhancements.
This is going to be a more exciting report.
Okay.
Let's turn to page 6, or 5. The state of South Dakota entered into a master settlement agreement. Maybe Doug Decker recalls what year. In the 90s, I believe. And in 2002, Governor Janklow came to a decision that that our state should securitize our future payments by issuing bonds, and we did that back in 2002. If you look at the top of this, the proceeds from our 2002 bond issue, we were able to deposit $243 million into a educational enhancement trust fund that our South Dakota State Investment Council manages. There's two components. There was a taxable side, those bonds were 6.72%. And then there was a Series B tax exempt, 6.65%. And they were due, or they were callable in 2013. So we've been eyeing refunding these because rates have come way down. Just to give you an example of rates, I put in a graph of the last year, a 10-year Treasury index, and if we would have been looking at this index 10 years back, we would have been in the we would have been 4.2%. We did the bond, we priced the bond issue in February, and we took those 6.72% bonds back 10 years ago, and we refunded them with about 3% bonds. So it created a lot of savings and savings in future debt service to retire the debt. So we work closely with Matt Clark with the investment council. We work closely with Attorney General to on this bond issue because there was a lot of enforcement of the MSA laws that we had to be cognizant of. We work closely with the governor's office. When we started looking at this, we were looking at a present value savings of $15 million. And we feel very fortunate that we hit the market at a point. If you look below the red arrow, but by the time we priced this in February, we were able to realize estimated present value savings of almost $43 million. So the timing just worked out slick. Now, if you notice that interest rates have jumped considerably after this, we asked the investment banker, well, if we would have issued bonds in this current market, they said that our present value savings would probably be more than $10 million less, probably more in the $32 million range. Now, it's still on page 5. Excuse me. The benefit over the life of this bond issue, the final maturity is 2027, so what's that? 14 years. The total benefit to the state is estimated to be $114 million. When you take the present value factor of 6.4%, that's how we get $43 million. So it was a great transaction for the state. And the state will realize this by our trust fund balance will grow, and the 16 quarter formula that rolls into the state general fund will benefit by the higher trust fund earnings. And with working with the investment council, we structured the deal where we maximized the amount that we could do taxable bonds and less tax exempt. Now, the important thing about that is they can, for the tax exempt investment portfolio, they can only invest in tax exempt investments, which nets them a lot less than their taxable investments. So they were happy to be able to have a bigger portfolio to invest in taxable bonds. Page 6, just wanted to point out that we structured this program where we have a very safe program where we'll have an average projected debt service coverage of 1.82 times. So we have debt service coverage means we would have enough revenue to pay the debt almost. If it was two times, it would be twice as much revenue as the expenses, but this is 1.88%.
Another feature of this, if you turn to page 7, in the 2002 bond issue, when we had extra revenues, we would prepay the bonds. They were called turbo redeem the bonds. This is a different structure where if we have excess revenue, we will remit it to the trust fund. And just on the last, the top line on the far right, that $1.6 million, we were able to transfer that to the trust fund in June of 2013. We expect to be able to remit similar payments, or hopefully more, through the final maturity of 2027. So that's kind of shows you how that trust fund builds in addition to higher earnings.
I got a question.
Yeah. Expense.
Okay. I'm just trying to follow here.
Sure.
Okay. You capitalize the tobacco trust fund was going to do an annual payout to us, and you capitalize that and use those payments from the tobacco to pay off the bond. How long do those payments, when do those stop?
Yeah. Yes, great question. I forgot to mention that. As part of the 2002 transaction, in order to give all that money to the trust fund, the state agreed to hand over the MSA payments until the bonds are paid in full. So the answer to your question, in the year 2027, the money will no longer go to the EEFC, the authority I work for. It'll go back, it'll remit back to the state.
Yes. Follow-up question, so when, but is there not an end date to those payments to the state?
The MSA payments?
Yeah.
I don't believe so.
Oh, really? So that's in perpetuity, that payment?
I believe so. I don't know of any end date to that.
It may be, Spence, it may be in this report that Aaron gave us yesterday.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing that.
I would be happy to follow up with that question and send the committee I'm sure the Attorney General's office knows that because they have a Mr. Pankratz that specializes in MSA payments.
The Education Enhancement Trust Fund, it says money into the Education Enhancement Trust Fund has six different sources. Revenues received under the provisions from the tobacco lawsuit between the first payment received in March 2020 and April of 2002, money from the Youth at Risk Trust Fund, earnings on the principal, revenues received from the assignment of tobacco payments, earnings on the money from the securitization and general fund appropriations. So I don't know if that answers anything or not.
Other couple of comments, if I could. Some states, quite a few states issued bonds, and South Dakota, I think, had foresight to put it in a trust fund and use it, the earnings for education. A lot of states use their bond proceeds to fund cash flow deficits and kind of stopgap measures. Our bonds, we've been fortunate that it was structured in such a good way that we've got higher ratings than a lot of the other bond issues because the MSA payments are based on tobacco sales, and that's been decreasing. So we've tried to structure both bond issues as safe as possible, and it benefit the state as well.
It is projected that the refunding will provide additional TSR to the trust fund and will increase the balance of the trust fund significantly by 2032. The year 2032, so. I don't know if that's...
I would be happy to follow up on that and send that to Fred.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you. Do I have a...
Thank you very much.
Do I need to approve this one? Do I need to do anything?
We just have a motion to accept that report.
Yep.
Chair, yeah. Will we accept the application?
Motion by Lateral, second by Olson. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Yep. Can I have a motion to adjourn the bonding committee?
So
motion by Tyler, seconded by Heineman. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Back into the executive board. Larry Lucas, your turn.
Wait,
thank you. Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the issues we've kind of discussed a little bit with the technology committee is if we want to improve or enhance our voting systems and on the floor and how our bills are read on the floors of the Senate and the House and in committees. And Lou is going to pass out, I know there were some copies, I don't know if they're up there, on a program called International Roll Call. There we come. And we have a rough estimate of costs, what this would be.
I think we just, she's going to hook up a computer.
Okay.
So.
When you look at the cost, I think this is something to look at down the road. We don't have anything in our budget for this, obviously, for fiscal year 15, but maybe it's something we could put in beyond that. The thing that's at an opportune time right now is that the wiring for the Senate and the House desks is underneath the floor, and this coming summer the desks are going to be removed from both chambers to redo the leaded windows are up above. So here's an opportunity where you got the desks out if you wanted to redo the wiring at a minimal cost and have that there, and then down the road look at adding in this other hardware and software for International Roll Call. And the other thing that's positive, they do have an alliance with Daktronix, so it's would help our South Dakota business there. That would be with the LED screens.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
First of all, I handed out just a little something about 50 years ago. In 1963, the legislature appropriated $15,000 for a loudspeaker system, and then they had money left over, so they replaced the carpeting. So that was just a little info. I don't have that from me. I'll read it up here. A little history on the voting system that we currently have. Daktronix was our original. We originally did a contract with Daktronix, and we did that in 1972. And we then upgraded in 1988, and it was $134,700. And that's when we installed the screens, and it was a added the display screens, we ran electricity and local area network lines. We the whole thing was ran by two IBM computers. One was down on the floor and one was upstairs in a closet. And an 8-port DigiBoard, which is our issue to date. It's old technology. And we have problems with our microphones. We have problems with the display boards, and that's due to that hardware being old. Then we put in put the voting system on the network. At first, it was just a standalone voting system. So we put it on the network so we could pass the information to the web in 1996, and that was $8,755 to do that. And then in 2004, we did a major software upgrade. We brought them into the probably the 19th century then. It was $100,000. And we changed the display bulbs, and we added three new computers, but we still have that 8-port DigiBoard, which is how everything connects together with the boards, display boards, and the computers. And we upgraded the software. So that's the history of where we've been with the voting system. When we were at NCSL, when I was at the NCSL conference, I sat down with International Roll Call and looked at their new software and hardware options. It's really nice. It's much more user-friendly. It's easier for the front desk people to operate. And I just thought then with the taking all the desks out that maybe we should start moving forward. Then we went to NALIT, the National Association of Legislative Information Technology meeting in North Carolina, and we saw some chamber automation in their legislature, which we thought was really nice. So with everything in mind, we just had a brainstorming between the two of us and decided maybe now was the time to do some changes, move forward in our chamber, in the chamber. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kevin, who will do what we brainstormed, and this, nothing has been decided, of course, and this is all brainstorming. We just wanted to throw this out, see what you thought, see, you know, if you do want to move forward, where we should go from here.
All right, one of the major changes that we saw between what was available in, for instance, North Carolina and other states is the actual console functionality. So here we have the yay and the nay and the, obviously, microphone that's available. Other states are adopting the ability to have a speak button. This actually places you in a queue so that then everyone's called upon the right order that they were elected that they would like to speak, as well as it's also then displayed on digital boards how many people have requested to speak. And, you know, sometimes that goes up and down as things are presented. But it was a nice ability to have on there. The other item was the ability to request a page through your console rather than trying to wave them down or request them by other means is a much more subtle way. And also saying that you're present by use of a button allowed a lot quicker for taking roll.
Takes away all the fun.
So one of the things they've updated was from right now we have a old electronics board with light bulbs, which you saw on the cost there. It was quite expensive just to replace the bulbs. Now, that doesn't mean that obviously a large LED screen's cheap by any means, but They do last quite a while, and you get a lot more usage out of them. With the audio and video that they've had in there, they've had integrated audio and video into the systems. So instead of South Dakota Public Broadcasting bringing in their own system, we would have it already set up. It would also be set up to key hotspots throughout the chambers so that when certain people were speaking, we could make sure that it was zoomed on them, had the right audio levels. And with those audio levels, we'd make sure we got that audio content. It could be converted into a transcript and used for closed captioning as well as be searchable. So if you said, well, I think so-and-so said this and I'm not quite sure, we could be able to provide that and you could look it up. Also, as we're moving through agendas, if we take our system now and we connect it to there, it seamlessly can tag and index where people have spoken on certain bills, which makes it easier for us to link those video and audio clips online for when people are trying to get information about what was spoken. Um, So with that automation, we also saw that in North Carolina and other states, they are providing this dashboard. This dashboard is web-based. It's for not only the members, but it's also they have an external one for the public. Some provide more documents or maybe a better, more detailed view of the agenda. But the idea is someone comes in, they have this URL, and they can choose, am I in the House or in the Senate? And then they can also see, do I want to know, go directly to what the current item is? So as we're going through the proceedings, we're on a new agenda that's already built into what they have available through their software. That would update what the current item is. We'd be able to grab that information and display that for people on our site. With that, we could display all the current documents that are available so they could read them, you guys could read them, and view them. They also could also color coordinate what passed, what failed. So at a glance, you can look back at the agenda and see what's been going on through the day. And we even saw where they had an amendment that came to the floor and they added it, and it wasn't on the agenda, and they just added it on the fly. It gets immediately added. It's available on the dashboard, and everyone right away has that document made available to them, which is really nice. You don't have to go through waiting for copies to be printed off. So with the access to that dashboard, that's obviously where people are going to be using this on their phones and on their iPads, that presents another question where else could we use these dashboards and these live agendas? And we were thinking maybe around iPad stations, getting rid of those large consoles that we have out in the hallways, putting the iPads on these pedestals or attached to the wall, or even removing the old bulletin board and putting the iPads there so that everyone can make sure that all of the agendas are as recent as possible. And they'd be able to go through, browse through whichever ones they wanted. And there's one that they really said, oh, I want to have a hard copy of this. We'd have printers available, and they could print that one off, and it would be available. But it'd just be slimmer. What's really nice is we're able to use older iPads, first, second generation iPads, because we're not worried about, if someone has an older iPad and they say, well, it's only lasting for 5 hours. Well, that's perfect for this use because this is going to be something that's hardwired all the time. You know, we're not worried about having the greatest camera or anything else. So it's a great way even to age out old hardware that we're using. And that's kind of what I have.
Yeah, it's on this sheet. This sheet. Well, questions? Isaac.
Thank you both for going and gathering that and presenting it to us. It's pretty exciting technology, and even as a new member, even though I was an intern before, obviously a lot of those things are some of the nostalgic things that we deal with, so a lot of us like doing it the old way, not saying that some of those things, but my question was, is there a way that you could have some of the new display screens and the new software without changing the buttons out, since we might not want to change those or might not want to have get rid of the roll call, etc.?
Yes, that was just an option. You can choose and pick whatever you want out of this whole thing. You could pick to do one part and not another part. It can be configured to whatever you decide you want.
Yes, Isaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other follow-up is it's so great to have the voice and the transcript automatically done and tagged. It just makes us all a little more careful with what we say, but it's good for the public.
Teason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what would be the timeline for us? We have to make a decision in coordination with next summer's or after session's work in the chambers. That's when we'd have to make a decision.
What we need to probably make a decision on first is when we have the desks out and stuff, the wiring part, we wire the members' desks. That part in both, first you have to decide if you're going to put one in the Senate.
No.
And then when that was out, we could lay the wiring in and get that done. And then it is up to you what year, you know, maybe the next year. Maybe we do it in two phases. Maybe we do the house 1 year, send it the next year. It's kind of up to you how you want to do it from there.
And there is the ability to have the dashboard without some of the other features as far as live updating and getting the live votes. But it, once again, it'd be more, you get a little less information, obviously, with it. It just enhances it.
Representative Holly.
If we just took the wiring route initially, what's the cost to throw the wiring in?
Well, this is really a rough estimate, because I contacted Mr. Schaefer on a Friday and he had this to me by Monday. But we're estimating $25,000 for the Senate and $45,000 for the House. I really think that's reversed. I think they got this wrong. Because No, that's right. Never mind, that's not the one.
I didn't see that there.
Any other questions? Just a comment from me. I'm of the philosophy that the Senate would just do nothing. Just because that's half the.
I know. That's usually what they do.
I know that. But.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. But no, I mean that's half the fun in the Senate is the voice voting.
And Mr. Chair, I would absolutely agree. However, I do believe we need new wiring for microphones and the technology for the front desk, so they don't have to use the old system. But the voice vote is part of the class of the Senate, I believe. So I would discourage any button voting in the Senate, but the wiring and the a technology upgrade at least to a certain degree, so we're not in the 18th century.
He's always ticking, isn't he? I mean, that's what we were talking about, is in the Senate, we sit there, and he got the yes and no, and we're sitting there ticking, tick, 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 tick.
That's the fun part.
Yeah, we're pretty dry over there. We don't have a lot of fun. But Senator Teason. Yeah, nothing. Oh, I got Isaac.
As far as the house rewiring goes, and incorporating the audio system that's integrated, that would be necessary probably to replace the wiring for that purpose. As far as the microphones go,
yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say it'd be a lot easier for you to just have that red button locked down, and you wouldn't have to say no.
Save money on just wire red. Just wire red.
I think one of the things you need to consider is that this would help engage people that are there in the gallery, too, where they would be able to see what we're discussing, and particularly amendments. And it could probably eliminate paper amendments. It could all come in electronically. And I think Lou even said, you know, if you had to write something out and you can write it fairly legibly, it'll even bring that in there so everybody can see it, so we don't have to distribute 35 or 75
paper copies.
Copies.
And change the rules.
Phyllis?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I don't think we need any action today, do we?
No.
No.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This is our new website.
Oh, okay.
This comes out. We're in the process right now of moving the data over. The bills are over, and we've done some testing today, and it's working. So they're continuing on. Our office is like kind of in lockdown right now. We can't do any of our access databases or anything till we get everything moved over. So we're in the process. It will be live. The morning of November 21st.
Wow.
Give or take 6 months? Or?
Yeah. Nope.
9 months. It's a state government.
We plan to put things that are happening, like when the budget address is going on. We plan to put that in the screen right here so that you can click
watch
on it.
Watch it.
When we're looking for intern apps, it will be in that slideshow also. You know, as things go through, that will change. As committees do their this is a test right now, but as committees do their agendas, it'll be right there under committees. We're trying to bring that more to the forefront. But everything that was there before is still there. We've enhanced and tried to make it easier. Also, at the very top, anytime you want to go back to the homepage, you just click on the state seal. It takes you right back to the homepage. As well as you go through things, there will be breadcrumbs, is what we call them, listed along the top so you can click and go back to whichever step you want to go back to. As well as we have changed it so that there isn't something called a current session. We have put them under years, 2014, 2013. Because in this time of the year and during the interim, current session gets kind of mixed up because right now we need to roll to 2014 and before the interim reports were in, we were kind of caught. So we decided we're going to put the year in front of everyone so we know what year you're in. And so that has helped a lot with that. But the whole office of LRC has worked on this. The executive branch was brought in to just get their ideas, if they liked it, they didn't, you know, give us some ideas. And because they use it probably more than anybody. And I want to thank everyone for their hard work on this because it's definitely been a group effort.
Is it a calendar year or fiscal year?
Calendar. 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 Yes.
Isaac?
Until you go under the budget, and then, of course, they operate on fiscal.
Representative Ladder, House of
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many legislators were brought in for the focus group? And just my first question.
We didn't bring in legislators because there wasn't time, and with everything that was, there was, we were going to do it, but with everything that's happened this summer, it didn't get done.
Yes.
And then on the website, if we have the problem with the site, are we operating in dual modes so we can revert back to the old site or the old databases if something were to go wrong? Is there a beta period, et cetera?
It's out there, yes. Kevin will take over the new site on Thursday, and we already have some enhancements that we want to do. And so we are 100% sure we're not going to have to roll back. I mean, we have tested and tested and tested all summer long trying to get this. So, but it's still there. It's all still there.
All right. Well, thank you for your hard work. Look forward to using it this session. So, all right. We got a few minutes left here. I just want to touch on that personnel policy. We haven't had a touch base with Doug Decker here on that, and just go through that real quick, 15, 20 minutes at the most, and we'll be on here a little afternoon. And if you have to leave before noon, just go ahead and go. We'll set a date for a December meeting, and we'll spend more time in the December meeting going through this personnel policy, but we should touch base on it just today. So. Go ahead, Doug, whenever.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Members of the committee, Doug Decker, Code Counsel, as this is a project that evolved, initially I was given the assignment to look at performance reviews. And in the context of looking at performance reviews and in meeting with the subgroup of the operations committee, it was suggested that the personnel manual should be revised. The NCSL had mentioned in the audit report that there was a personnel manual from 1999 and that it was dormant. Well, it's dormant like a statute's dormant. Something that was passed in 1979 is still the law. And so we had a personnel policy that was still the personnel policy for the Legislative Research Council staff, and it probably needed to be updated. So in part of that process, I looked at the old 1999 personnel manual. I discussed with the Department of Legislative Audit. I looked at their personnel manual. They provided their personnel manual to me to see what information was included in their manual and in the context of their performance review. They use the system that is developed by the Bureau of Human Resources. In addition to that, I looked at the Bureau of Human Resources employee manual that's on the state website. It's accessible to everybody. And the reason for that is, you know, even though you have separation of powers and legislature is separated from the executive branch, we're all state employees. So everything that deals with leave, benefits, the pay, salary policy is basically what is provided to other state employees. So there was no need to look beyond that and incorporate as much of that as possible into this. And then finally, there is a resource from the NCSL that provides model personnel manuals from other states. They had compiled a bunch of information regarding what other states do in relative to the things in their personnel manuals. They had suggestions. They'll have two or three different types of suggestions for if you want to develop a mission statement or if you want to how you identify leave or whatever. So from those four sources, I put together this rough draft. And that's where, you know, I picked things from the old manual that are still relevant. I picked things from the Bureau of Human Resources, which mainly dealt with, you know, leave and things of that nature. I looked at NCSL to see what they suggested should be included that may have been missing from our old manual. And then I, you know, those were the four sources. So I'll be glad to walk through all of the sections. It's organized this way just for convenience. I mean, there is no, if you think things should be organized differently, that's, you know, it certainly can be done. It's double-spaced so that people can make notes. If you, you know, have an idea or want to change something, there's room to make that change. Each idea is expressed by itself. You know, that's why it's so long. It's 56 pages. If you condense it down to, you know, single spacing and have one idea follow after the other, it's going to reduce down to, you know, 24 pages or so, I'm guessing. That's why it's organized the way it is. You know, like, if you are familiar with the legislator reference book, in the NCSL report, you will see some of the ideas that were conveyed in both of those documents in the introduction there where I say, you know, welcome to the LRC. You know, it was recommended in NCSL and others that you, you know, start off by explaining yourself, who you are and what you do. And that's what the first three or four pages are. The disclaimer is important. The disclaimer identifies that you know, this provides general information. It reemphasizes the fact that we're at-will employees, that this is not a contract, and that the executive board reserves the right to change features in here when the executive board desires to make the change. It also has a clear statement in there that any previous manuals are revoked so that we put an end to any confusion that there may be. Does 1999 apply or does this apply? And that it identifies that this manual, it's anticipated that we would put this manual on our website so that that's where you have access to it so that it doesn't suffer the same fate as the 1999 manual in that it was done, put in a drawer, and we all forgot it was there. So, I mean, so this will be available for people to review on a regular basis, and I also view this as the opportunity to meet another recommendation from the NCSL audit report in that there needed to be ongoing communication and discussion and education by between the LRC and the executive board about what the staff does, so that an annual review of key features of the personnel manual can be done, and it'd be a regular agenda item to review the manual. It would also be a regular agenda item when there are new members. This is available. Here's what you look at. And here's if you have a better idea about how to do something, then you know we can accommodate that. The mission statement, you know, it's I tried to be brief, concise about why we exist. The services we provide and the services we don't provide, that's how we implement that mission. And I understand that's going to generate considerable discussion about what we do and what we don't do. But, you know, that's why it's there. Confidentiality, we needed to identify how we try and maintain confidentiality. You know, that is something that was developed in-house, and it varies from the old manual. It varies from what NCSL has. It is developed by us. Us meaning the LRC staff. There was input from everybody that is subject to the confidentiality requirement about how we view the requirement of confidentiality and how we propose to implement it and how we expect it to be applied. Moving on from hours of work was something that was mentioned in the report. This provides a general statement about how we view that. The rest of the items, you'll see that it's mainly from the Bureau of Human Resources website. I tried to craft it to fit the LRC. Those aren't new ideas from me. They are ideas that other employers, the other big employer of the state, the executive branch, applies to its employees, and we basically follow the same requirements.
Doug?
Yes.
In that hours of work, do you need to sometime mention about flex time, like during session when you work longer hours, then you can take some time off? Is that mentioned somewhere in there?
That's, if you look at compensatory time.
Oh, okay.
That's in
where is this?
Page 23.
Oh, okay.
If we work, the LRC staff is exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act. If there are excessive hours worked during immediately preceding session or during session, you can bank some comp time, and it's at the approval of the director or your supervisor. It's not unlimited. It's not that, if I've been spending the week playing video games on my computer and not getting my work done, I'm not going to be able to then say, oh, geez, I had to work Saturday to get my work done, and bank 8 hours of comp time. So there is some control by the supervisor and the director on how you build up comp time, and it's limited to session.
Sure.
And that's a reflection of current practice.
Okay. Great.
Like I said, that I did a rough draft of this early on. It was shared with the research staff, fiscal staff, support staff. Anybody that would be affected by it. Everyone had a open and opportunity to comment, offer editorial remarks, good idea, bad idea type suggestions, and many times those ideas overlapped between the people that provided input, and I incorporated as much as possible to still keep the document the way it is. I'll conclude my remarks there and answer any questions you might have.
Does anybody have any pertinent questions? I think we'll set a meeting in December, and we'll come back and we'll really probably go into this in a lot more detail. We approved this preliminary manual yesterday in a big sweep of motions. I think it was Holly's motion to approve recommendations 3 through 8 or whatever, and it was in there that we would adopt this personnel manual on a temporary basis. And then next month we can come in with ideas and changes and things like that after we all have a little bit more time to digest it all. So is there any questions at the pertinent time? Senator Teason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments. First of all, I want to commend Mr. Decker for the work that he's done on this in a relatively short period of time to put this together. There was some sort of an emergency nature that we needed to get this updated. As he said, until yesterday, we were flying under the personnel manual from 1999, and that obviously has some very outdated sections there. So I appreciate the quick work he did on that. I also have to tell you, having read my fair share of personnel manuals in my lifetime, that I very much appreciate the fact that this is a very readable. A personnel manual is no good if nobody reads it, and if it can't be read and easily understood, it doesn't have any effect. This one appears to be very readable, concise, and to the point, and gives appropriate direction to employees. So I like that aspect of it a lot. Obviously, we do need to spend a little bit more time sort of digesting this probably and then making and tweaking it to our liking. I would suggest that, pages 7, 8, and 9 on the mission statement and the services provided and the confidentiality, those things that, directly affect the organization would be prime considerations for us to, think about and determine. That's really our purview to do that. This is suggestions from our staff. I think they've hit the target pretty close myself, but we may want to tweak that to some degree. So, again, I appreciate the work that's been done on it. I feel more comfortable that we're in a better place now than we were with the old manual, and I look forward to discussing it more at our December meeting and hopefully a finalized. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Senator Heineman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would echo what the senator said. Thank you, Doug, for doing all your work. And I think this is important for us to have something in front of us to start evaluating it. And I think on an individual basis, we need to really think about it, maybe talk to some of our other legislators as well. And then I think in December, we really do need to have, I think the discussions we had yesterday were important for us to sit down and really discuss some of these things. I go back to one of the comments in the NCSL where it said the responsibility for positive change does not only sit with the LRC. Legislators and legislative leaders must also participate in and contribute to efforts that improve the LRC and its services. And then they go on to say that we all need to be better informed about LRC operations, and I think that's really true. I've learned, and I've been around a long time, I've learned more things in the last couple of days as well, just in terms of some of the things that Doug has talked about, some of the things that Ruben has talked about, Annie and Fred, getting a sense of all of the different operations and what our expectations even could be and should be. So I think especially in page 8, we really need to spend some time as a legislative or as an e-board to really talk about what do all those things mean? What's under all of those things? Bill and amendment drafting, the research for the development. What does that all mean? What are the different bullet points underneath that? So I think in the December meeting, whether we do it, with the facilitator or whether we can just do it as a committee, but we really need to sit down and visit with the staff and say, what do all these things mean? What do we think they should mean? What are some of the other things that we think are important? Representative Holly brought one up yesterday in just our subcommittee meeting. So I think these really deserve our conversation and our attention, and I look forward to December to do that.
Great. Thank you, Doug. So, well, crew, that takes us to the next question. As you look at your calendars, the 9th or the 16th are both Mondays in December. The 25th is on a Wednesday. December 25th is right in the middle of the week of a Wednesday of the following week.
I think I'm busy on the 25th.
Are you?
Yeah.
Scratch.
Let's see the 25th.
Who celebrates that? The 16th is kind of what I was leading to. That kind of gives us a month. Let's.
I should have my pictures from the Danube by that time. I'm back in the 15th, so we'll have a slideshow.
Okay.
So,
is the 16th acceptable?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll set that as our next meeting date. Probably come in, but we'll probably do a personnel subcommittee meeting and a few sub other committee meetings about 9 o'clock. Kick off the full e-board by 10:30, and hopefully we'll be on here by 3 o'clock that day. So, what is it? What is the 16th?
Yeah, criminal justice oversight.
Where? What time?
1:30 to 4:30 maybe. So we might be able to
skip out. Just, yeah. Maybe we can start a little bit early, do subgroups at 8. I don't know. I'm just talking out loud to make, and then to get out of here. Because I don't anticipate. Okay, you won't. 16th doesn't work for you, okay? Is it the 9th?
No,
DC. Oh, that's NCSL and all that other stuff, I suppose. 16th and.
A lot of work out in the morning.
Yeah.
Telecom.
Yeah. I'm going to start at 8, do some subcommittees in the meeting morning from 8 to 9, and get started about 9:30. So, and we can be out of here by 2 o'clock. So, all right.
Did you want to reference the meeting with the caucuses?
Yeah, I think that's what we're going to, Fred and I are going to put some details together. We'll come around to the caucuses on the budget address day and kind of give an update to all the caucuses of what's going on.
Are you going to schedule the budget day again by time?
It's always at 1. The budget, usually at 1. Your chair, your caucus, your leader should have all that information. So.
It is
1
p.m.
And then we'll get in touch with, like, Bernie, and I'll talk to Jason and make sure we can get some time set aside there to come in and visit with your caucuses, too, along with the Gosh and Lust and also Rave and Lederman. So, all right. Anything else to come before the executive board? If not, a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Motion by Olson, second by Teason. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned.